happy day.
Oh, happy day.
When Jesus wore.
When Jesus wore.
Oh, when he wore.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. And this is going to be a packed hour, all with good information that can allow us to live a longer and more peaceful life. We're going to have the latest on health and healing. My guest in the second part of our program is Greg Pallast. And we're going to talk about the other data collection operations far worse than Cambridge Analytica. You haven't heard about it. No one's heard about it. But Greg, we're going to share the latest insights on that. I'm going to do a commentary today on police violence, keeping it in perspective. There are over 500,000 police in the United States, and yet we should not be having the types of violence that we're seeing. So I'm going to address that, a special commentary from John Whitehead, Enough is Enough, Police Violence Plagues America, and where that could lead. I have a commentary today for the millennials, and in fact, for all people who are not highly read. It's good to have an athlete, as many of us did, when we were growing up in small towns and neighborhoods across America in the 1950s and 60s and 40s. Generally, these were people like Lou Gehrig and Willie Mays, Hank Aaron, Mickey Mantle. But I didn't want to offer, and the person I consider the greatest male athlete of all time, and I wonder if you could guess it. Who do you think was the greatest male athlete of all time, the most versatile, the most talented, with great handicaps against that person? Let me know by going to prnstudio@gmail.com if you can guess who that person is. But I want to share with men and women the people that we could be looking at their life, reading their work, and inspired by their insights today, even if they lived 500 years ago. Their truths are universal and timeless truths. So I'll be giving a commentary on some of the greatest minds to inspire us today. Plus, from our audio file, we're going to have a National Security Agency person on that you have not heard, Russ Tice, interviewed about, was it possible that the National Security Agency was blackmailing President Obama? Then, from Heather McDonald, how much more delusional can university students get? And then from a real firebrand, he was formerly a communist and then a member of the socialist movement, and he is simply one of the smartest guys on the block, but he's an agitator, Brendan O'Neill. And this is where he talks to millennials in a way that will not make them feel good about themselves, but could help them. And about how they actually worship the establishment, the very thing that they condemn. That's our show. Let's get to it. From the University of Leeds, a new study suggests that a diet free of red meat significantly reduces the risk of a type of colon cancer in women. And that's important because colon cancer is a really tough cancer to deal with, and it's very common. And the University of Leeds researchers were part of an international team that assessed whether red meat, poultry and fish, or vegetarian diets are associated with the risk of colon cancer and rectal cancer. And when comparing the effects of these diets to cancer development in specific subsites of the colon, they found that those regularly eating red meat, there's your hamburgers, hot dogs, sausages, bacon, and pizza. And those who did not eat red meat, oh, a huge difference. And cancer was found on the descending section of the colon. That's where your feces is stored. And that's because the red meat, it doesn't ferment like cabbage or yogurt. So you get positive, good probiotic bacteria. Instead, it putrefies. And that putrefaction is filled with toxic bacteria. And that toxic bacteria then stays in contact for longer periods of time as a meat-based diet doesn't give you regularity. You don't have the same peristaltic movement because it's also high in fat, and fat slows down digestion. Just visualize every time you have fat in a diet, it's like driving at 70 miles an hour on a highway and suddenly go to 5 miles an hour. That's the difference when that fat goes in. That means that toxic chemicals are going to spend more time interfacing with the lining of the intestine. That's where your polyps, inflammation, and cancer develops. And from the study, the impact of different types of red meat and dietary patterns on cancer locations is one of the biggest challenges in the study on diet and colorectal cancer. Our research is one of the few studies looking at this relationship, and while further analysis in a larger study is needed, it could provide valuable information for those with a family history of colorectal cancer. And by the way, more than 2.2 million new cases of colorectal cancer, also known as bowel cancer, happen around the world. Very common. So, want to have a healthier colon? Less likelihood of polyps, abscesses, inflammation, and cancer? Mediterranean plant-based diet. From the National Institutes of Child Health and Human Development, published in the peer-reviewed journal Hypertension, elevated blood pressure before becoming pregnant and early in pregnancy is going to increase the risk of pregnancy loss, even if the woman doesn't have a hypertension diagnosis. Quote from the study, elevated blood pressure among young adults is associated with a higher risk of heart disease later in life. And this study shows that it may also have an effect on reproductive health. So if you intend to get pregnant, a year before that, start your detoxification and cleansing protocols. And that can help you have a chance of having a baby born alive without defects. Otherwise, you can have up to 1 in 3 babies dying in miscarriage or birth defects. And that's almost all due to what we're putting into our bodies. By the way, both the man and woman should detoxify and rejuvenate themselves to have healthier sperm and healthier capacity to have an egg fertilized and go to full maturity. From the University of Paris, published in the Journals of Gerontology, the question is raised, can a Mediterranean diet slow aging? And they wanted to look at this, and they looked at all the other studies, and they looked at the data, and among their findings, a series of 6 new articles highlight the underlying mechanisms of the diet. A positive relationship between the diet and physical and cognitive function. That's why many people in Europe, even though they're older, totally different than older people in the United States. They don't have the high heart disease, cancers, diabetes, and more importantly, they have much longer cognitive ability, meaning they don't have the dementia, Alzheimer's, and memory loss at the same level that we do in the United States. It's night and day difference. And I've noticed every time I'm in Europe, I spend time in the country, and I interview people. And it's literally as simple as it seems. Give you one example. My brothers and a couple of buddies who are Italian, including a physician, they drive a car. I run ahead of them because that day I'm just running the whole day in the mountains. And we come up to a village, and my buddies just say, we're Americans. And this fella who's out here running, he'd like to know more about your health and how you've lived such a long life. And would you be willing to talk with us? without exception. They smile, they're happy, they open their house. It's just such a warm, wonderful feeling. I found that in Spain. I did not find it in France. I found it in certainly in Italy, found it in Ireland, Scotland, not in England. People have different attitudes, not just about Americans, but also, why do you want to know this? And I found the people very relaxed, working at ease. If you look, you see real strong musculature, because these people walk a lot. They don't just run out and buy a week's worth of food at the mall. They're out every day harvesting food. Or if it's winter time and they're not outside, they're inside, generally very large barns that an American farmer would be very, very envious of, because you're looking at oak beams so huge that just one beam would run $25,000. And they've got like 60, 80 beams in a barn that could be 400 years old. And they have all kinds of, you know, they'll make cheese, they'll make yogurt, they'll dry herbs. They have kegs, like 100 kegs with different dried olives, and or not all, dried olives, but they're processing olives and sun-dried tomatoes. So it's a different experience. And it's just making yourself vulnerable and putting yourself in that environment. In any case, I ask them, how frequent and at what ages do you see mental decline? And I get this smile coming back. This is very common. Well, we have someone, there's always someone in the family who runs their own apothecary, their own natural pharmacy. And they know what to eat. And suddenly and this is where the women dominate. If you want to see love and responsibility equally shared, go to an Italian family. A, the matriarchy controls the children, the house, the garden, everything that goes on daily in that life. She's the boss. Everything starts and ends with her. Other things, like in an agrarian society, fixing the equipment, farming, that's the husband. And she will tell you all about which foods to take depending upon what conditions you have. And you get just a real lesson. It's humbling to see how much these wise women know about their brains. And we think, well, they're out in the country and they're not watching a lot of television. What could they know? They know 1,000 years passed down. One family was in the same house 700 years. So if you travel outside the United States, and I also found this true in the Caribbean. I found it true in Jamaica. I love Jamaicans. They're some of the finest people. You find this in Haiti, in Bermuda, in Trinidad. And you'll find it where people have had, out of necessity, because they're not wealthy people, they've had to rely upon folk knowledge and self-sufficiency, which herbs to grow, which fruit. Go anywhere in the Caribbean and say you know someone who has cancer. They'll all tell you the same thing, soursop. And it grows in everyone's backyard, that and cherimoya. And indeed, they're correct. The scientific literature on the anti-cancer properties of soursop is terrific, including the leaves of soursop. In any case, this particular journal, Journal of Gerontology, running the 6-article series, showed that there was a positive relationship between the diet and physical and cognitive function. And the value of taking coenzyme Q10 while adhering to the diet, and the role of the diet in reducing inflammation. And but it depends upon how strictly you adhere to the diet. Quote, greater clarity on how this diet is defined in both interventions and observational studies is a critical part of the consensus. And so what they found is you stick to a Mediterranean diet. There's your grains, your legumes, your pulses, your beans, very big on beans, and bean stews and bean dishes. Lots of staples in the diet, like fresh vegetables every day. They like to consume it on a daily basis, harvested that day. They don't want to get something that was grown in California 2 weeks ago, harvested, trucked across the United States, packed into a supermarket, and harvested green, not mature, because then it's tasteless. So They're very big on taste. Go to a market anywhere in Europe. Anywhere in Europe, you watch and they pick up a fruit or vegetable. They look at it. They smell it. They feel it. And that's their senses telling them yes or no. And they're really good at it. They can thump a melon and tell you whether or not it's mushy inside or immature inside or just right. So anyhow, they're fresh fruits, fresh vegetables, cold-pressed extra virgin olive oil, lots of nuts, and they just walk around snacking on nuts and seeds. And that is where they get their fat. Olive oil, nuts, and seeds. And they do consume moderate amounts of fish. And they don't have a lot of dairy, but it's fresh dairy. If they get milk, it's generally non-homogenized milk. And it's very, very rare that they use the processed meats. So there are a number of scales used to measure adherence to diet. But those who really stuck to a healthy diet, it helped them age slower, giving them more years to life. Also, from Harvard University, they looked in the United States, and guess how many Americans, according to the CDC, have high blood pressure? Just guess. We have 331 million Americans. 71 million adults in the United States have high blood pressure. Well, 71 million adults, when you have about 80 million who are 18 and under, that means that over a third of all American adults have high blood pressure. Then you have even a higher number, half of all adults, are overweight or obese. And then you have one-third of all adults who have prediabetes or diabetes. So we have a lot of problems. But what can help? Here's the good news. You can lower your blood pressure with help of olive leaf extract. Now, olive leaf extract had a shocking ability. I mean, it was really amazing to see how low it could get your blood pressure. But it was also shocking the percentages of death rate for hypertensive adults. Let me just put this in perspective. If you're overweight, then you got a problem. I don't care if you have no aches or pains, you've got a problem. You cannot stay overweight. You're going to shorten your lifespan. If you have high blood pressure, according to this Harvard study, you have up to a 400%, quote, 400% higher than those who don't have high blood pressure of dying. Okay? That's a big deal. So we can get our blood pressure down with garlic, onions, and also very important would be olive leaf extract. Because after all, remember, uncontrolled high blood pressure can cause an array of life-threatening conditions, including atherosclerosis, stroke, kidney disease, heart failure, and heart attack. Now, although high blood pressure is officially considered to begin at 140 over 90 mmHg, most physicians typically don't intervene unless readings go much higher, for instance, in the area of 160 over 90. And this, I believe, is costing lives. The fact is, as blood pressure nears 140 over 90, damage to arteries and organs can already be occurring. And studies have shown this. Tremendous increase. In fact, heart disease doubles with every 20 over 10 degrees percentage increase in blood pressure above 115 over 75. Now, there's a lot of ways of getting it down, because if you have high blood pressure, the likelihood is you're going to also end up with swollen ankles, gastrointestinal bleeding, fatigue, dizziness, kidney impairment, and excess potassium in the blood, and increased risk of heart attack. So olives and olive oil, rich in healthy monounsaturated fats, are really heart healthy. But also the olive leaf extract at 1,000 milligrams is also good for you. So that's the latest on health and healing. We're 20 minutes in the program. We're going to take a break. Come right back. Please stay with us. It's nice to have everyone with us today. Thank you for joining in. I believe that it's time for the millennials to start to realize that in the real world, you may not always have that safety blanket. You may not always have a parent to live with. And many people who are millennials are living with their parents. And that can be a stress upon the parents. And there's also a time when you have to get out on your own and not burden, because someone has to pay for the extra food, the utilities. And if you're in front of your computer every day because either you don't like the work you've been given or you feel it doesn't match your education, understand there's a consequence. There's a certain group of young millennials who've taken the position that anyone over 30 is out of touch with their needs, that they have their own language, they have their own sense of being, and that my generation, the baby boomer generation, has caused most of the problems we see in the world today, which is true. And the seniors are out of touch with everything. They're just waiting to die. And so it's only very young people who have an awareness of the world we live in. I'm pretty sure every generation figures that they're smarter than the previous one. But you're not. And my generation, at least those who were active in the 60s and the 70s, who didn't go back into careers, but rather stayed as good citizens, caring about our neighbors, our family, our friends, and some basic values. We didn't put making money or getting ahead in this race of life as our priority. We live with a balance. We didn't waste time and we didn't waste our energy. But there are others who came before us. And I want to share for the men first some of the men that we should be looking up to. These are men in their time, not always appreciated, sometimes scorned, sometimes attacked, because they were provocateurs or they were original, so original that everyone else who couldn't begin to comprehend their creativity were resentful of them. Some were okay in their time. People accepted them. So please write down some names, because these are important. Goethe. Now, you can Google them and read about them. Try not to read the short Kimball editions. Actually get one of their books and read it. Let me spell it for you, because it's not spelled the way it sounds. Goethe. In my opinion, he was the most brilliant man in world history. And there's a lot that verifies that. And there's, I won't go into all of his background. I'll let you find that for yourself. But he, any of us who've read his work would concur. But then you have Baruch Spinoza, S-P-I-N-O-Z-A. Brilliant man, Martin Luther King Jr., Gandhi. Malcolm X, the Dalai Lama, Leo Tolstoy. You might not have heard Leo Tolstoy, T-O-L-S-T-O-Y. He was a philosopher, he was a novelist, but he was a really big anti-war activist and believed in animal rights. John Muir, he was an early environmentalist. One of my favorites, a person I met and knew, Krishnamurti. Krishnamurti, one of the most pragmatic thinkers. He chose not to be deified. He chose not to be everyone's guru. And he chose to live a simple life. But he was profoundly insightful. You want to have someone that really motivates you? Krishnamurti will. Aldo Leopold, he was an early environmentalist working on preserving biodiversity. William Blake, Martin Buber, the great Jewish philosopher and existentialist. Ernst Becker, he wrote Denial of Death as well as Escape from Evil, two seminal books. James Luther Bevel, a leader of the 60s Civil Rights Movement and director of the Nonviolent Action Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Aldous Huxley, again, one of the most brilliant men ever. He was a philosopher, he was an anti-war activist. and he was a critic of modern society's flaws. Albert Camus, philosopher, spelt C-A-M-U-S. Franklin D. Roosevelt. Karl Marx. Albert Schweitzer, S-C-H-W-E-I-T-Z-E-R, great humanitarian, brain physician, and dedicated to helping those in Africa. Thomas Kuhn, K-U-H-N, a brilliant mind. He was the first to posit the concept of paradigm shift. Henry Thoreau, great naturalist, and he was an essayist. He looked at the common condition of people's minds, how they lived, what they devoted their time to. He was the one who posited that you cannot be both a great good citizen and a good person. Choose which. You also had Emerson and Alexis Tocqueville, Michael Montaigne, one of my favorites, Voltaire, V-O-L-T-A-I-R-E. And probably the most caustic and insightful social critic ever, Oscar Wilde. He was an Irish playwright and author, and he was famous for his anti-war pacifism. Mark Twain. Twain was as close to Oscar Wilde in his cynicism of life and politics. Then someone who's still alive today is Fritjof Capra, C-A-P-R-A, and Fritjof is F-R-I-T-J-O-F. I've had him on the program many times. He is a physicist, and he went out of the public limelight for 30 years, and he's just now coming back. He combines physics and mysticism. And Chief Sitting Bull in Black Elk, Frederick Douglass, and Inozo Nitobe, N-I-T-O-B-E, early Japanese agricultural economist and educator. Again, these are brilliant minds. William Penn, a philosopher and early advocate of democracy and religious freedom. Ulias Muria, M-U-R-I-E, a biologist considered the father of the last frontier and a champion of wildlife. Walt Whitman. Thomas Paine. Alfred Hermann Fried. He was the Austrian Jewish pacifist and founder of Germany's peace movement. Benton McKay, M-A-C-K-E-K-A-Y-E. He was the father of the Appalachian Trail. Allen Ginsberg. Johan Galtung, G-A-L-T-U-N-G. He was a Norwegian sociologist and mathematician. He was the founder of the Peace Research Institute of Oslo. Carl von Osticzky, O-S-S-I-E-T-Z-K-Y, German pacifist exposing German rearmament before World War II. He was executed for high treason, but they gave him the Nobel Prize in 1935. Immanuel Kant, K-A-N-T. Rupert Sheldrake, who we just spoke to last week and we're filming him for a new documentary I'm doing. He is just simply one of the most phenomenal minds on the planet today. And he looks at human biology in a way that mainstream science denies. T.Z. Suzuki, S-U-Z-U-K-I, a Japanese philosopher and Zen teacher, probably most responsible for mainstreaming Buddhist philosophy in the United States. Alan Watts, Avicenna, A-V-I-C-E-N-N-A. He was a famous Muslim philosopher and compiler of medicine and one of the greatest poets, and he had wonderful philosophy in his poetry, is Rumi, R-U-M-I. Now, there's a lot more, but those can get you started. For the women, for the young women, for the mothers who have daughters, why don't you write down a few of these names and ask them to really look the backgrounds on these women up, to read some of their writings, so you can understand how they can motivate to a higher ideal, a greater understanding of how to live in peace with all people. Sojourner Truth S-O-J-O-U-R-N-E-R. She was one of the heads of the women's rights and civil rights activist movements in 1883. Simone de Beauvoir, journalist, philosopher, women's rights activist. Susan B. Anthony, a journalist and civil rights activist. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, back in 1902, civil rights activist. Margaret Fuller, back in 1850. She was a literary critic and a women's rights activist. Mary Wollstonecraft. Now, you have to go back to this scholar, educator, one of the first women's rights activists, one of the best. 1797, great philosopher. Also, Julia Ward Howe, poet, civil rights activist. Pearl Buck from my state, West Virginia, civil rights activist and author. I interviewed her the year that she died. Lillian Wald, a children's activist, nurse, and labor activist. Dorothy Day, a founder of Catholic Workers, religious leader, and anti-war activist. Rosalie Edge, early environmental activist. Susan Sontag, a journalist and anti-war and women's activist. She's alive today. Christina de Pisan, P-I-S-A-N. She, you have to go back to 1430. She was a journalist and one of the first women rights activists. Mary Walker, a surgeon and civil rights activist. And in fact, the Kenyan founder of the Green Belt Environmental Movement to plant trees throughout the world. She's alive and well today. Wangari, W-A-N-G-A-R-I, and Mathai, M-A-A-T-H-A-I. Margaret Mead, one of the great anthropologists and women's and civil rights activists. Jane Addams, an anti-rights activist and philanthropist. Then some of the really interesting ones who have wonderful lives. Maria Curie, Amelia Earhart, Harriet Tubman, Anne Frank. Now, Anne Frank, we know today, not because she did anything profound. She didn't. She was only 13 years of age when her father, Otto Frank, and her mother and her sister had to escape Germany. And her father was a successful business person, and his father was well known. And he had a place in the Netherlands, and they had a business there and in a spice factory. It's small. It's like a four-story building. And so they had comrades who were Dutch and not Jewish who worked with them, and they built a bookcase up on the third floor. So where there would have been a four-floor walk-up, there was none. There was just a bookcase. And behind that bookcase was secret stairs, and then up there was one very cramped space where there are like three rooms. And then a friend of theirs, a husband, wife, and son came, and then another person. There were eight of them all told. And they lived up there for 2 years, a little over 2 years. And then, and it was really difficult because they couldn't wear shoes during the day. They couldn't flush the toilet or run water during the day because that would be heard downstairs. They couldn't walk around. They couldn't look out windows, someone might see them. So they had to live very quiet lives. They couldn't argue, and food was rough. Their friends would get them food, but one of the places that they got produce was across the store. That right on the corner, right across from the building, was a little produce store. But that person had been arrested because he was also hiding Jews in his home. That closed down their source for vegetables. And so they would take their coupons, and they would get food, and they would share it. And there were times when they would only have one small potato per day each, or maybe a piece of bread. On one occasion, they brought them up, their friends downstairs who worked there and was overseeing the building. They brought them a little cake, and they had to cut the cake in little tiny slivers, but each person got a sliver. And they were so joyful about that. And then one day, the police came. Now, here's what's interesting. The police didn't know they were hiding there. They actually didn't come for them. They came because word had gotten out that someone was artificially making or, you know, counterfeiting these little books that gave them stamps that, you know, that people could get food with. And they were searching there. And in the process of searching it, they found the bookcase, because it didn't take a genius to figure out if you've got three stories and you walk outside and you see five stories of windows, well, where in the hell are the other two stories? I mean, it's just common sense. And so it was about 2 hours or 2.5 hours of searching then for these coupon books. And then they found the stairway and they arrested him. And Otto Frank lived. I don't think he died till 1985, about 90 some years old. But his whole family died. And the three of them, including Anne Frank, she was only 16 when she died. She died just 2 weeks before the liberation of the concentration camp. And her sister died just shortly before that, and her mother died just before that. And the mother died because she kept giving her food each day, as meager as it was, to her daughters. And Anne Frank was not a hefty person to begin with. So they died of malnutrition. What made Anne Frank famous was because she wrote a diary. Every day she kept the details of their lives and their little dramas and her flirtatiousness with this other young man who was about 3 years older. He was 16 when she was 13. And the kind of things that everybody would imagine you would go through if you could never go outside, if you had to keep the drapes drawn all the time, if you could never make a noise, if you could never play music. And so that left you with the type of thing that they did, which was read and whisper. And only on the weekends. But then there was all kinds of conspiracy thoughts of who turned them in. Was it the cleaning woman who came in to clean the building on the weekends and heard them? Was it one of the workers who for 2 years had been getting bribes every payday, and after he'd get his money, he would turn and look at that stairwell as if, I know what's up there. So to keep him quiet, they gave him. It turns out he didn't know anything. It was a bluff. So the reality is that all these people who thought that someone turned them in, there's no evidence of that whatsoever. There is evidence that it was all about the police believing someone was forging their ration books. But anyhow, her diary was later published. Her father got it. And of what it was like to be a young Jewish girl living under occupation conditions, fearing imminent arrest. Every time they heard a siren, she would write how that would, you know, send their hearts racing. Because they were unarmed and had no place to go. And when people were arrested, high probability they would have died. So any young woman, any young man should definitely read Anne Frank's diaries. She died in 1945 in March. And by the way, the last German trolley to take prisoners from the city to the concentration camp, that's the one she was on. Had they just not been caught that day, she would have survived. In any case, Helen Keller, Joan of Arc, Florence Nightingale, Clara Barton. Now, women who are alive today who I have an enormous respect for, and I believe all young women and men should read about these people to be motivated by them. Alice Walker, author, civil rights activist, Angela Davis, scholar, academic, racial, and civil rights activist, Vandana Shiva, S-H-I-V-A. She's an international Indian food and women's activist, mostly anti-GMO and anti-nuclear, but all of her work is based upon the spirituality of Gandhi. Mariana Williamson, she's just wonderful. She's the founder of the Meal on Wheels program and Project Angel Food and co-founder of the Peace Alliance, and she is one of the most important women, in my opinion, in America. Charlene Spretnak, a retired professor of female theology and regarded as one of the first theologians for ecofeminism and co-founder of the American Green Party. Angel Toya Williams, African-American Zen Roshi, black feminist, working in inner-city communities like Harlem. Joanna Macy, very important eco-biologist and Buddhist feminist. Joan Halifax, perhaps one of the more important in pioneering hospice and death work. Winona DeLuke, a Native American eco-feminist. Sister Elizabeth McClaster, became Father Philip Berrigan's wife, and peace and anti-Vietnam activist, and she was a member of the Harrisburg Seven. And Daisy Kahn, K-H-A-N, founder of the Women's Islamic Initiative on Spirituality and Equality to empower Muslim girls and women. So instead of just looking at athletes, and there's some really good athletes, but there's an awful lot who are very talented as athletes, but they've contributed nothing else to the world, nor would they or do they care to. But the people I just mentioned for men and women, these people cared about humanity. They sacrificed for humanity. All these people are beacons of authentic spiritual enhancement. So that's the millennial gift today, to work together towards a better future. Back in a moment with my guest standing by, and from wherever he's at today, I think he's in Los Angeles, Greg Palast. Please be staying on board. You're going to have an interesting conversation. Now let's say hello to Greg Palast, P-A-L-A-S-T. He's a journalist, and he is breaking some very important information with our audience today. He writes for The Guardian, Rolling Stone, British Tribune, and he's written many books. He's also won many awards, including the National Press Award and the George Orwell Courage in Journalism Award. He directed the film The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, and which follows Donald Trump's wildest claims in Billionaires Gone Wild. And he's in best-selling book, including, Greg, what is your latest book?
Okay, the latest book is the update of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, and which followed Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, and both were Times bestsellers, but afraid the message didn't take hold.
Okay, Greg, in the aftermath of the exposure of Cambridge Analytica, the data collection operation collaboration with Facebook and run by Trump's former advisor, Steve Bannon, some terms have entered the public lexicon. Not that it has been that sophisticated, but terms require some explanation. Psychometric profiling and caging, because Cambridge Analytica is only the tip of an iceberg. And as you've said, not a very sophisticated company. There are several that are far worse in gathering people's personal information and using it for social political activities. And two of these are I360, owned by the Koch brothers and Karl Rove and Paul Singer's Data Trust. But first, give us a good overview of how these companies conduct psychometric profiling, and why should we be concerned about what profiles about us individually are given and to whom and to what ends? The form is yours.
Okay. Thank you, Gary. And by the way, very moving discussion about Anne Frank. That was wonderful. And to prevent the kind of police spy state that ended with, as Anne Frank faced, we need to be aware right now where we're heading. There's a big hoo-ha over Cambridge Analytica, and I don't want to discount the dangers of the company. What they're doing is that they're gathering private information on you. not just to figure out what touches you and will sell to you, but whether it's candidates or products, but also to deliberately misinform you. It's interesting that the Trump campaign talked endlessly about fake news, fake news. Cambridge Analytica literally held out, and we got this on tape recordings and secret meetings at Channel 4, a station I work with out of Britain, went undercover. And they promised right-wing candidates around the world, alt-right candidates, that they will spread disinformation about their opponents, whether it's Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders or in other nations. And that includes, by the way, and go a little further. For example, Cambridge Analytica offered to set up your political opponents with hookers and tape it. So it's not just benign gathering of information. Now, Cambridge Analytica uses psychometric profiling. And part of that, to find out what's important to you, they stole, through deception, millions and millions of Facebook profiles. But, of course, those you kind of make kind of semi-public, or at least for your friends. Now, that's Cambridge Analytica, which was created, run by Steve Bannon, created by what I call the brown shirt right-wing billionaires, the Mercer family. But there's other billionaires with their own database operations. And you mentioned the Koch brothers. Believe it, of course you would believe it. The Koch brothers have a far more dangerous, far more sophisticated system called I-360 Themis. They maintain 1,800 data points, moving data points on you. So they use dynamic psychometric profiling. That is, they follow your credit cards, your cable TV habits, your purchases, etc., and far deeper into you than Cambridge Analytica. So, for example, and this is true because I have some of their 1,800 data points that they delve into. They can tell, the Koch's right wing candidates about each voter. They can say whether you've downloaded porn and ordered Chinese food before you voted. And as my expert in my film says, Mark Sweetland, he says, that's pretty creepy. He knows these guys very well. But it's more than creepy because they use, for example, the Koch brothers do more than simply track your purchases. This is much, much deeper than your Facebook profile. They track your purchases and cable TV habits, et cetera. Much more, and that's deeper into you, into your privacy. But, and by the way, you gave that all away when you signed up for that credit card. Take a look at those 12 pages of stuff you said, I accept. But, for example, the Kochs found out when Scott Walker was facing a recall. That's the right-wing governor of Wisconsin. The spinoff of I-360 used their database to send letters to gun people they identified as gun owners in Wisconsin that are registered Democrats and normally vote absentee and live in rural areas. What they did was send letters to these Democratic voters saying, protect your gun rights, very important, vote in this election, and here's where you mail in your ballot, and here's the date you have to mail it in by. Well, the date was too late for your vote to get counted, and besides, it was the wrong address anyway. That accounted for Scott Walker's not being Scott Walker's virtually owned by the Kochs, winning his recall race. They then took it to the swing state of North Carolina and did the same thing, identifying Democratic voters who normally mail in their ballots and giving them the wrong address and the wrong date for mailing in their ballots. Then they rolled it across through the Southeast in the 2016 election run-up. This is the type of creepy stuff that they do. It's not just learning about you to figure out how to manipulate your emotions and thinking, but also how to misdirect you. And then we have the third one, and you mentioned this, data trust. Another one you should be, that unfortunately you've got to fear. Data trust is controlled by the guy that George Bush called Turd Blossom. Most people called him Bush's brain. That's Karl Rove, who has this another massive database, Data Trust, and he's used it for nefarious. Here's one of the tricks he used called caging to take away the votes of voters of color. He took the list. And by the way, Data Trust's number one client is the Republican National Committee. The RNC the Republican National Committee worked with Data Trust to send letters to black soldiers, for example, at the Jacksonville Naval Air Station, to black students at black colleges, historically black colleges, who are away on summer vacation. Why they send letters to these people? Well, the soldiers were in Iraq and Afghanistan. The students were away on vacation. They sent them letters to these voters, registered legally. If you're a soldier, you're registered at your U.S. home base, usually. And by the way, it's legal for a soldier to vote for president of the United States, just so you know. Believe it or not, they are U.S. citizens, but they vote from their home base. The letters were saying, do not forward. In other words, don't send to Afghanistan. Don't send to the students' homes elsewhere. When they mailed those letters and they came back and they were gathered into literally a physical cage where they were there then opened, these caged letters, these return letters, were used to challenge the right of these people to vote, saying that they didn't actually exist. They were ghost voters, not legitimately registered to vote. So in other words, they literally stopped soldiers sent overseas from voting. They stopped students from voting because they didn't get a letter during summer vacation. They even sent letters to the homeless shelter, for example, in Jacksonville, Florida, because they know that homeless men, who are, by the way, American citizens and can vote, but took away their vote by saying they don't exist because they didn't respond or they didn't get their letter at the homeless shelter where they are registered to vote. Creepy, creepy stuff. That's Data Trust. That's Karl Rove. That's the Republican National Committee. So it's not just that they learn about your intimate self, especially the Koch's I-360, which is definitely the most dangerous and intrusive database, but they actually use it to actively take away your vote. And that's just the beginning. There's more databases, more evil afoot.
Okay. Are there any other companies similar to I-360 or Data Trust that we should be worried about? And second, Banyan and the Koch brothers that you just mentioned and Rove you just mentioned are all engaged in the radical conservative corporate agenda. Aren't there any non-liberals or Democrats leading companies doing this also?
The Democrats do have a database. In fact, Barack Obama used it very successfully to get elected in 2008. It was a very sophisticated operation, but no one has ever found them making an illegal intrusion into your private data. No one has found the Obama database company to have misdirected people and thrown away their votes. They've not used it for caging to challenge people's votes. It was simply, an advertising operation with a major, with a big database. But, it wasn't like basically a spy operation and an espionage and sabotage operation. It was a voting operation. I mean, I'm not always crazy about these databases and how they can be used. But, if you're just using them for pure advertising and activism, it's fairly benign. I think part of the reason, too, is that Democrats know that the more people who vote, they tend to do better. The Republicans know if you can discourage people from voting, stop them from voting, challenge their vote, they're better off. So you do end up with the alt-right and the right-wing being much more active in basically fraudulent, illegal, and according to the lawyer I work with, Bobby Kennedy, felonious activity. He called it a go-to-jail crime, what some of these guys are doing. Why aren't they in prison? Direct violations of the Voting Rights Act.
Greg,
even more databases. Go ahead. Sorry.
We have time for one last quick question and answer, and that is the Internet is a fantastic place to hoodwink people. There are many social media sites, but very few people know who is really behind them or how they earn revenues to keep operations going. And there are surveys that show us up in our emails, and we assume that they're legitimate, but we can't really be sure. Again, who are these people? So what are some of the means these data collections and surveillance companies use to get private information from us? And what do you think should be the outcome with Facebook now that they've lost about $80 billion last week and they're taking a hit and it's not just ending quickly? This is continuing this week.
Well, one of the problems is that the business model of Facebook and other such operations is to sell your data. I mean, you have to wonder how Facebook survives. It's a so-called free service. Well, except you're giving them something of value, an entire profile about yourself and your activities and your feelings and your, you know, your keywords and the things that touch you. So that's what they're selling that. And that's the other problem. Then also you have these surveys, which you know, if you've ever answered a survey, be careful, my friend, because that's now being used to open up your life and being used to match that data against other data, identify you, and then figure out how to manipulate you or mislead you. This is dangerous stuff. The sale of your private data. Now, I know that everyone, you know, you click that button, I accept, after you see that big, giant block of print that goes on for 20,000 words. In there is, you basically say, I'm allowing Facebook or these other sites to sell my data. It's in your credit, and many credit card companies and others are doing the same thing. It's dangerous stuff. You know, be careful with this, and also be careful of who's sending you. If you don't know who someone is who's sending you a survey or something like that, don't answer it. You know, do protect yourself. And it's getting worse. And at the same time, we have, for example, Trump's what I call vote thief in chief, Kris Kobach, the Secretary of State of Kansas, who works also, gets funded by the Kochs, who has a database supposedly of 3 million people voting twice. It's called the cross-check list. And he's using that. He's knocked off hundreds of thousands of voters before the 2016 election. Now they're trying to use the Homeland Security files to remove so-called alien voters. They're using a database, I can't make this up, Gary, to identify what they call un-American names. This is Kris Kobach. His database identifies un-American names like Garcia and Hernandez and Wong and Chung. Those are the un-American names who are potential alien voters, and they challenge their right to vote. This stuff is super dangerous, and that's one, the official actions of people like Kobach with cross-check and the alien voter list, which is just starting now, that's got to be stopped right now. And in addition, Facebook and other operators have got to get out of the data selling business. It's not just data. It's selling your life. And, you know, would you allow someone to sell your family photo album to creeps? They're doing that. Now it's electronic. They're selling your personal life. That's got to stop.
Greg, thank you for all the good work you do. And anyone wanting additional information, you can go to Greg Palast. That's PALAST.com. I look forward to our next conversation, Greg.
Thank you, Gary. Mm-hmm. Bye.
We're out of time, everyone. Thank you for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.
I've had my share of life's ups and downs.